Chapter 2. Regina. Hubert Scholes was coming home. Jen yawned and flung the shutters of his room wide to invite the chilly pre-dawn breeze to pry open his eyes the rest of the way. His own efforts had failed. He had slept little that night, finding that an evening of rigorously practicing his repertoire of songs for Hubert's return celebration only set his mind to lively wanderings that chased sleep away, despite finding himself in the comfort of his own bed for the first time in nearly 2 weeks. The second-story window of his room overlooked the last of the green road and commanded a pleasant view of the dense alewine forest. Dying night winds that set the forests to sighing and bending wafted the fermented scent of autumn's decay into his room. A statuette of a hideous Uyumak on the table caught the weak pink light of the clouds and shifted its colour from night black to the brown of the table. Jen picked it up and regarded it, its colour changing to match that of his fingers. Raphael had gifted him the statuette when he had shown a fascination with it as a boy. The long, powerful legs and the gangly arms terminating in vicious claws marked this Uyumak as a hunter. The different breeds of Uyumak had different bodies designed for different purposes, but all had the same face, a circular mouth ringed with triangular teeth pointed at the centre of the hole, slightly protruding so it could suck meat into its maw for the teeth to devour. A set of three nose holes formed a triangle above the mouth just beneath an inset crevasse in the conical upper skull, which held a row of glassy black eyes. His statuette had nine, though Raphael said that some had as few as three, while stories from the Mikikian Wars talked of some having as many as 20. The thought of all those eyes moving about sent a shiver down Jen's spine. The statuette imitated the talent of the Uyumak's scaly skin. It changed colours to match its environment. Some of the songs he'd prepared the night before told stories of the creatures hiding nearly invisible in the deep grass or woods for a chance to chase down a horse or tear apart an elven scout. The miniature statue had scared and fascinated him as a boy, and to overcome his fear, he took to giving it the name of whatever person in town annoyed him at any particular time. The habit stuck. The statue had borne Hubert's name many times before. Jen considered the snotty, stupid son of the town's magistrate the worst of the Scholes' lot. His only redeeming virtue was that he didn't play favourites. He tortured everyone, including his own kin, until loneliness drove him to relent enough for those with short memories to come within earshot of him again. Jen's memory was not short. After Hubert threw him in the well behind the church when he was 10, Jen had avoided the brute diligently. He set the statuette back on the book-laden table and shut and latched the shutters in case rain or wind blew in while he was out. Quietly, he took the creaky stairs down to the kitchen, though his stealth was unnecessary. Raphael was already there, slouched over the table with breakfast at the ready. Jen drank the cinnamon tea and ate the barley cakes slowly, hoping they could throw off the grogginess and get him into performing condition. Raphael looked as tired as Jen felt. The old bard usually slept until the sun was well past full up, and rising early in the morning disagreed with him. He had combed back what little straggly grey hair still clung to his scalp and donned his performing clothes. His pants and shirt were baggy on him. During the successful years of his barding, he had eaten from the larder of lords and ladies and grown plump. The food of his retirement was less rich and less abundant. If he were telling the truth, Jen wanted the same travelling life as his master, hoping Baron Forthrickshire would permit him to travel to Cairum, the capital of Tolnor, or even to other shards such as Tenswater and Rugoth. Staying in Tell would resign him to a life of inconsequence and boredom. The poor town was good for one thing only: lumber. Few travelled the long, unkempt green road that connected a string of towns set on the southeastern edge of the expansive alewine forest. The farther north the road went, the smaller and less frequent the towns became until at last one arrived at Tell, after which no permanent settlement could be found all the way to the nearly impassable reed steppes and red wind desert. Despite the constant cutting of branch and tree, The wood still threatened to overrun the towns built with and sustained by it. Tales passed down from the first woodsmen to work the timber told of groves cut down one day and regrown the next. While Jen had never seen a tree grow overnight, the townsfolk waged a constant battle to keep the seedlings out of house, garden and field. Under the previous magistrate, every mid-spring the children would be let loose to pull as many suckers and saplings as they could from around the buildings in town, the child who brought in the most winning a rabbit or a bronze piece. Very little else of importance, however, came from Tell, not in product or person. Few people outside of the nearby towns of Sipton and Hazelwhite knew Tell existed at all, and they were mostly relatives of the townspeople who had worked the forest and the land for several generations. The folk in Tell, especially the older ones, enjoyed the solitude and separation, while the young did little more than dream of leaving. Some of the apprentices accompanied their masters as far west as Green Wall, when the lumber was sold. Their tales of the inns, festivals and pretty girls set the rest of the young men to longing for adventure and travel and to a great deal of complaining, mostly to unsympathetic parents, about how dreadfully dull Tell was. Jen agreed with them. Only two things had happened in the last 20 years that people thought amounted to anything worthy of talk, and Jen was one of them. While orphans were not rare in Tell, ones who wandered about naked in the woods with burn-scarred feet were. They said Jen was only 3 or 4 years old when a lumbering party found him sitting in a tree. They took him to the woodmaster, who in turn gave him to the care of Tell's young churchman, Pureman Millersham. The Pureman diligently searched for the boy's parents in the small towns along the road, but with no success. At first, the strange circumstances of Jen's appearance caused the normally friendly families of Tell, long accustomed to raising orphans, to shun him. While the forest might provide for their bread, the people believed it a fey and dangerous place. Pureman Millersham ardently preached against entering deep within the shadowy boles, as he said, "Worshippers of the dead goddess Owena kept watch over the trees and practiced strange rites. A child found in the wood, therefore, was an ill omen, especially considering the strange condition of his feet, which conjured images of strange rites by firelight." People whispered in low voices that Jen was the kin of cultists, and they waited to see what he would become. The pure man gave Jen his name, and entrusted the strange boy to the only person who took vocal pity on him, Raphael. The retired bard had just bought the status of freeholder with earnings from the success of his trade and settled into the large, abandoned farmhouse. After Jen was successfully placed, the town mothers would often pluck and fuss about how the boy should have a proper mother, though none wanted the job personally. To add further controversy, Jen's skin was pale white, his eyes green, and his stature tall, all marks of noble heritage, unlike the short, stocky and swarthy traits of most Tolnorian peasantry. For a time, Jen remained a thing of conjecture and gossip, but as the boy grew under the tutelage of the learned bard, his strange history faded in importance, and he became a regular part of the town, though not an ordinary one. Raphael was learned in law and in the ways of court. Before long, Jen stood out for his manners and speech rather than for his mysterious origins. The coarse, rough-and-tumble boys of the rural town had plenty of reasons to despise Jen, as their parents continually used the bard's apprentice as a standard of sterling behaviour. "Why can't you be more polite, like Jen?" "If you had half the sense Jen had, you could learn a thing or two from Jen about how to behave." The ill feelings died off as they grew older, and Jen demonstrated that he was neither aloof nor conceited. The fact that few, if any, mothers would allow their daughters to take the orphan bard seriously helped, too. As the boys started their apprenticeships, something Jen had embarked upon years before, Jen became a mentor in finding ways to romance the young ladies of Tell. He felt foolish giving advice about something with which he had no personal experience, although he knew the heart-wrenching tales of his trade. But experience or no, Jen's reputation as a bard and as a young man grew. His voice was strong and clear, his fingers nimble upon the lute. His easy manner endeared him to the townsfolk, with a notable exception of the Scholeses. Only the glint of cunning intelligence in Jen's eye, his refinement of speech and his appearance marked him as different. In all other ways, he was a boy of the country. Raphael always looked on Jen with a proud glow, and had said more than once that the boy would go far, the good baron permitting. The second notable thing to happen in Tell was the placement of Hubert Scholes into the armies of Duke Norshwal. While the Scholeses were technically nobility, they were not the kind that mattered. Somehow, however, Bernard arranged for his son to serve in the Duke's regular army. At first, Hubert seemed mortified at the opportunity, but his father saw to it that the town paid him the proper attention and respect, things the entire Scholes family held in short supply. And Hubert soon took to strutting around as if he were a king, lacing the ears of the young ladies with all manner of fabulous tales about the adventures and dangers in which he might find himself, and which every boy in town hoped he would find himself. In Tell, the general lack of news made even stupid fiction incredibly interesting, and Hubert enjoyed his own inventions as much as anyone. When the snow finally broke on Hubert's 16th year, he was sent off to Grey Tower, an arduous journey from the eastern edge of the dukedom to its capital. Bernard pressed the townspeople into a great production for his departure, even though the unusually long and harsh winter had depleted their stores. The magistrate had even gone so far as to buy new dresses for several of the more attractive young ladies, so they could line the road and wave their sashes at his son as he left. The dresses were collected directly afterward, however, and sent to be resold elsewhere. Hubert was soon and pleasurably forgotten, and life returned to normal until that morning in late autumn when Raphael came with an order from Bernard to collect his apprentice from jail. Hubert would return the next day, and once again the Scholeses demanded that a festival be thrown in his honour. Celebrating Hubert's departure, while inconvenient, was at least palatable because he was leaving. Jen thought that working up a festive attitude for Hubert's return would require the type of cheerful disposition only the truly ignorant can possess. Everyone else would need to pursue a drunken stupor and endure his arrival the best they could.
"Well, lad," Raphael mumbled, voice weary, "let's get to it. Bernard said he wanted us to play from dawn to dusk and then some. And dawn is nearly broken."
"We will get some breaks, won't we?" Jen asked. He wanted some time to have a little fun himself. Starting the festival so early was as insensitive as it was ridiculous. Everyone knew Hubert would arrive during the late afternoon at the earliest.
"Of course," Raphael answered sarcastically. "The magistrate is a considerate man."
Jen grunted and stood, gathering his cloak and his instrument, which he wrapped in a blanket.
"You'll have to retune that once we..." Raphael began.
"I know," Jen cut him off. "I've done this before. We play it all Peace Day in the dead of winter every year."
"No harm in a reminder, especially to the tired, which would be you, or the hungover, which would be me. Let's say the oblation and get going. If you would do the honours, Jen, my mind is still a little foggy."
Jen nodded, and they both knelt. "In Eldoloth's name and for his sake, we to his servants oblations make. To the Ha'ulric, our loyalty and our might. To the Shalane, our reverence and our life. The world broken due to sin, they twain will make whole again. The moon's our witness in the sky, the soul, the body, the blinded eye." After finishing, Jen helped Raphael to his feet and they left the house to take the short walk north to the town square. Their breath steamed from their mouths and nostrils, and they pulled the cowls of their cloaks up over their heads. Due to the absence of traffic on the road, Jen thought they might just be the first to arrive, but as they came to the square he saw that several of the townsfolk had arrived earlier, setting up booths and games. Jen doubted the balance of the populace would arrive until it warmed considerably. After waving a greeting to several familiar faces, Jen and his master crossed to the permanent platform set on the east side of the church. Jen sat on a three-legged stool and started tuning his lute absent-mindedly, his thoughts again turning to the reason for their early morning performance. Why Eldoloth, in his supposedly benevolent wisdom, had chosen to curse their small town with a family that could torment a city several times Tell's size,
escaped the most careful of his reasoning. No matter what Pioman Milisham said about not judging others, Jen knew, as did everyone else, that Eldaloth would never let the Shoals family set one foot into the paradise of Erelinda. And if he wouldn't let them into Erelinda, why did he send them to Tell, save to make the townspeople suffer? Bernard Shoals lauded the fact that he was magistrate over everyone with every effort he could muster. He'd managed to get the position some 20 years ago, a favour from his distant cousin, Duke Norshwal. The relationship was so distant, in fact, that if it were a town, Jen calculated it would take a good 3 months to get there on a fast horse. Magistrates weren't even within sniffing distance of real nobility, but they were above serfs, freemen, and merchants, and Bernard Shoals exaggerated the minuscule status gap as much as possible. Despite Tell's glaring insignificance, Bernard acted like he was the magistrate of Cairum itself. Jen imagined, however, that even magistrates of more important towns and cities had the good sense to behave civilly toward those they governed. But Bernard treated anyone below his rank with palpable disdain. Every look, every frilly outfit, every word was meant to put the puny people in their place and to remind everyone of his own elevation. Why the man would want to live with and rule over a town full of people he despised puzzled Jen until his studies in history led him to understand the extreme pains men would endure to garner themselves the smallest bud of power, no matter how insignificant it might be in terms of the larger tree.
"My boy," Raphael said, "that look on your face, it's positively black. I can only hope I'm not the target of whatever darkness you've got swimming around in that head of yours."
Jen broke out of his reverie and smiled at his master. Most had expected the old man to die years ago, though he had proved tougher and more resilient than folks half his age in a town where winters killed the weak. "Fear not, Master de Bellemaine," Jen replied formally. "None of my ire is for you. I think you know the throat my black thoughts are squeezing."
"I think so, but don't tell me anything about it. I'd like to answer, and truthfully, I know nothing when the time comes. But I beg you not to be too extravagant in any plots you might be hatching. You can be expelled from this town, you know, and forced to face the Baron. I've got a wonderful house and the biggest collection of books in this dukedom. They're yours when I die, if you can manage a bit of restraint."
Raphael told Jen this often, as a deterrent against any rascality his young pupil might engage in. Raphael had no children of his own, none that he knew of, anyway. The old man made it widely known that he had chosen Jen as his heir. Jen was very thankful. Jen knew the books Raphael collected over a lifetime were worth a fortune in most places, though no one in the town seemed to value them more than a barrel of beans. Since apprenticing with Raphael, Jen had read most of those books. At first it had been a struggle for Raphael to harness the young boy's youthful energy to the task of reading, but eventually Jen had come to love reading so much that Raphael had to try doubly hard to pry him away from books long enough to learn music. "Well, if I can't manage restraint," Jen said, "I'll do my best to be discreet. But trust me when I say that the victims will be most deserving."
"Please," Raphael pleaded, "no more. I enjoy a good outhouse prank as much as anyone, but I'm an old man and want no trouble till the snow gets me and I sneak my way into Erelinda. Besides, what need is there of such dark thoughts when fair creatures like that one are about?"
Jen followed Raphael's gaze out into the square. Few people had arrived, but Regina had just left her house to greet a group of young men who had been loitering around her porch. Without reservation, Jen and every other young man in town proclaimed Regina Morwald, daughter of the merchant George Morwald, the most beautiful creature, besides the Shalane, of course, to grace Keyhall, or at least the towns near Tell. All the young men wanted her, and she knew it. Unlike most other girls in town, Regina was tall and not huskily built. Her mother was the third daughter of a baron, and Regina had inherited her finer features from that lineage. While Shalane was beauty beyond comprehension and far out of reach, Regina's face was there to be doted upon and dreamed about.
She was the closest to what the boys imagined a noblewoman looked like. Everywhere she went, tossing her blonde locks about and flashing her big blue eyes, a hopeful entourage of suitors accompanied her. Jen was no exception to this worship, finding any excuse he could to be near her, though to find her alone was about as likely as hearing an intelligent word come out of a Shoals's mouth. In addition to her many fine qualities, she was also the only young lady in town who had learned to read and write, her mother sending her off each spring to be tutored in Green Wall. Thus, Jen felt his claim upon the girl was better than most, for when he did manage to talk to her, there was a connection of the mind that he doubted she found with any of his competition, who could talk of little more than trees, hunting, and livestock. Though most marriages were arranged, the town boys still bragged, fought, and showed off for her as if it would make any difference. But smart young men such as Jen thought himself to be, knew that one secured the hand of a young woman by acquiring the good opinion of her parents. Some parents, though rare, actually took into account the affections of their children. Most, however, looked to pair their offspring with someone that was good for them, or who would raise the family's social station. To those in love, however, all this parental bargaining meant less than a tin piece in a gold pile, leaving the countryside strewn with heartbroken, forlorn lovers when it came time for marriages. At least, that's what many of the songs were about. Jen hoped he could find a happy ending to the song he sang in his heart every time Regina smiled at him. He'd certainly tried to win her, though she would never speak of anything she felt for any man. She kept her feelings away from scrutiny, and all Jen could ever do was guess and hope.
"It's a pity, though," Raphael continued, "that Regina gathers so much attention when there are an abundance of other eligible young ladies about. Take Lorraine Fairweather, for instance. There's nothing wrong with that young lady. Kind, sweet, good cook."
Jen put his lute down and blew on his hands to warm them. The Fairweathers had invited him and Raphael to their house a fortnight ago for a dinner prepared by Lorraine to impress Jen. While Jen appreciated the fact that one family in town thought him good enough for their daughter, double bastard and barred apprentice notwithstanding, the way her parents looked at him, like one would look at a cart horse before buying it, set Jen's skin to crawling. Remembering the dinner, a rather tasty honey-basted ham, sweet bread and potatoes, prompted a rumble in Jen's stomach despite his breakfast. Marrying Lorraine would not make him happy, but it would make him fat. "All I can say," Jen said, "is that it's hard to think the moon's a bright when the sun is in the sky. I'm sure Lorraine will garner her fair share of attention once someone puts the sun out of reach, so to speak."
"You have the right of it there," Raphael agreed. "The mystery is, who will drag the sun off into the sunset? How about you, Jen? I've seen her smile at you in that particular way from time to time, and you have a gift for words that no other young man within 50 leagues of this place has. I know you've been thinking of her."
Jen smiled weakly. The chance that Regina's parents would let her marry an orphan was slim, though Jen had done his best to get in their good graces. He paid for his goods in a timely fashion. He watched and cleaned the store when they were away. He'd even performed free of charge for a small gathering they had when George's brother had come to visit from Sipton. "I think the Morwolds like me well," Jen said. "But Regina? I don't know. She smiles at me, yes. She talks to me, but she does much the same with every young man in the town near as I can tell."
"A generous, happy heart is a wonderful thing to find in a woman, Jen."
"Yes, but such a heart complicates discerning where a man stands in relation to others. I feel like there is something between us and had told her as much, but she says nothing. It may not end up mattering anyway. I doubt the Morwolds will let their daughter marry an orphan, much less one who is a bard and a serf, no matter how much they may like me. What sane parent would let their daughter marry a bard after all?"
"Hey,"
Raphael protested, taking Jen's bait.
"There's plenty for a woman to like about living with a bard. Well, I never quite found the right woman."
"Why, Jen?"
A soft voice broke through Raphael's retort.
"I'm sure a bard would have a lot to offer a young lady."
Jen spun to find that Regina had approached unnoticed, while he was conversing with Raphael. She stood wrapped in a light grey woolen cloak, looking up at him on the platform. As always, her eyes were full of confidence and playfulness, and her mouth was turned up in a lovely smirk, the kind of smirk that rendered Jen weak-kneed and almost speechless. Almost. "Why, Regina!" Jen greeted her grandly, hoping to deflect the conversation. "Welcome to our little festival in honour of mighty Hubert Scholes, the greatest slouch ever to play dice on the Tolnorian frontier. And I bid welcome to you too, Cale, Keegan and Thad. I see you've wasted no time in finding and following the most lovely young lady in town." Jen took Regina's hand and kissed it dramatically. The three young men scowled when they saw Regina's smile. Raphael nodded in approval. Regina's eyes brightened.
"Why, thank you, Jen."
Regina, Cale popped in quickly, trying to recapture Regina's attention. "Want to come see the pheasant I tracked down and killed? That's real big. My pa hung it up over there and we'll cook it later."
"Quiet, Cale," Regina remonstrated. "I was talking to Jen, and it is not polite to interrupt. I'm sure I'll have more than enough time later to hear all about the big birdie you caught."
Jen loved how Regina's tone of voice made it impossible to tell whether she was mocking you or not. Jen couldn't figure out if she did it on purpose and suspected that part of her tutoring involved learning to be devious. While it was frustrating, Jen loved it.
"So, Jen," Regina continued, "you sounded ever so rude when you referred to our young hero of the day. I certainly hope those comments don't make it back to our town magistrate."
By the knowing glances of the three young men behind her, Jen knew they would tattle on him. Not that Bernard really cared about anyone else's opinion. If he did, he would certainly have killed himself years ago.
"Well, I'm sure the magistrate knows that I think just as highly of Hubert as everyone else does."
Regina grinned knowingly, and was about to reply when a voice, shrill and grating, broke across the square.
"Hey, Raphael!" Bernard yelled. "You and your layabout apprentice should be playing! The second watch has passed and the sun is up! Now let's hear some music!"
Bernard wore an unbelievably bright red coat and breeches, both trimmed with white rabbit fur. The coat bulged over his belly, though recent expansion of his midsection brought the bottom of the coat up short of the belt. The colour of it clashed with what little red hair the man had left. Set against the muted browns, greens, and greys of the town, the magistrate's outfit involuntarily drew everyone's eye toward him, which Jen supposed was the point. Jen raised his eyebrows and sighed.
"Alas, my lady," he apologised, "I must ply my trade."
Regina pouted in mock disappointment. Or maybe it wasn't.
"Then do play it. I apparently have a date with a deceased fowl. If you can manage it, find me for a dance or two. I believe Master Raphael is more than skilled enough to hold the stage without you."
Raphael bowed and swept the stage with his hat in a gesture of gratitude for her compliment, groaning slightly as his spine cracked and popped while reversing the effort.
"I will make a point of it," Jen replied. "I wouldn't want you to forget about me, since you find yourself in the company of so many excellent young men this morning."
Regina winked at him and turned to go.
"Where's the music?"
Scholes bellowed as Regina walked off, young men in tow. Raphael began a quick beat on the drum, and Jen joined in with the lute. As if lured by the music, people emerged from road and path to fill the empty square. While many of the men and women, especially those who had to set up booths, were obviously angry about being there, the children enjoyed every minute with each other. After greeting friends and family, the adults soon overcame their annoyance, and before midday, the festival lurched into full swing. The Scholeses only condescended to occasional appearances in the square as the day went on, not wanting to mingle with the common folk too much, save to watch for their son coming down the road, and to yell at Jen and Raphael if the music stopped. Jen wished he could step down and enjoy himself with the townsfolk, though he liked the applause he received after he sang a song. Jen had taken over most of the singing duties of late since Raphael's voice tired quickly and had a scratchy quality. Still, the old man could ring out a good chorus now and again, and the people always applauded, having great affection for the old performer. Few towns could lay claim to such talent.
Jen, Raphael whispered after concluding a song, I must say your voice is sounding more and more impressive every time I hear it. I had my doubts about you a few summers ago, but you've come along nicely. And by the way, there's a certain young lady that's been watching you.
Jen searched the crowd expecting to see Regina's blue eyes, and instead finding the brown ones of Lorraine Fairweather. Unlike Regina's looks, Lorraine's were a sledgehammer of meaning.
Gotcha, Raphael said, cackling as only an old man can.
Jen rolled his eyes up into his head. Don't you torture my poor heart, old man. Jen tried to be mad, but couldn't. When do you suppose Hubert will drag himself into town?
I'd reckon around sundown,
Raphael replied.
He was supposed to ride out this morning, provided he didn't stay up late engaging in what little debauchery can be found in Sipton. While I share about as much enthusiasm for the boy as you do, it'll be nice to hear what news he has. Ogmere is obviously planning to attack the northern border sometime soon, that is clear. It appears it won't happen until next year, since the snows will be here before long.
Jen shook his head. I still don't see why they would want to attack us at all. The Haulrik is going to be the ruler of all nations in 2 years. Even if Ogmere were to win, they would essentially be taking what is already to be theirs.
Indeed, Raphael agreed. But you forget that Torbrand Cairn is still the Shadan of Ogmere, not his son. The Haulrik is only your age. The Shadan is a lusty man, the most feared warrior of our times. He wanted to unite the three kingdoms when he first took the throne, arguing that the united rule should begin as soon as possible. If Ogmere's way of life were not so divergent from our kingdoms, or from Rugoth's, it might have happened. He half considered attacking Tol Nual then, but our alliance with Rugoth kept him from it. If he could gain control of the portal to Rugoth, he would have probably attacked. The Portal Guild made sure that wouldn't happen, however.
The tales of Torbrand Cairn were indeed awe-inspiring and frightening. It was said that no man could so much as tire the Ogmerian leader in single combat, much less lay a mark upon him. The last three Shadans of Ogmere were of the Cairn family, and in a nation where all positions were determined by challenges and deadly combat, having three Shadans of the same family in succession was a rarity. Jen tried to digest Raphael's information. So you're saying he's going to get thousands killed because he wants to fight something, and our nation just happens to be on the same shard?
Not exactly, Jen,
his master replied.
No doubt there was some insult or provocation we don't know about. Shadan Cairn and his blessed son met with all the nobles from the three human nations this spring to arrange for the transfer of power after the Haulrik's marriage to the Shalane. It was after that meeting that rumour of Cairn marshalling his forces first trickled into our little town. Honestly, I suspect that our young king has broken the Fidelium, for that is the only circumstance I could imagine where Rugoth would not come rushing to our defence, and we have heard nothing of it.
Out of the corner of his eye, Jen noticed the magistrate coming out the door of his two-story house and knew the conversation was almost over.
Broke the Fidelium? That would be absurd.
Jen couldn't fathom it.
It would, but I can think of nothing else that would precipitate a war this close to the marriage.
Jen's mind spun. He barely paid attention to Bernard's red-faced complaints. Every leader of all three nations signed the Fidelium upon the inception of their rule, promising to relinquish their thrones to the Haulrik upon his marriage to the Shalane so that the nations would be united against the threat of Mikik. While the finding of the Haulrik in the nation of Ogmere was distasteful to the Tolnorians and Rugothians alike, as far as anyone knew, neither the King of Tolnor nor the First Mother of Rugoth ever conceived of not honouring the holy contract first signed under Pontiff Athelion IV over 200 years before. Bernard's nettling left Jen little time to consider the import of Raphael's conjecture, and the day passed slowly as they played song after song. Watching everyone have fun, while the magistrate pinned him to the stage, soured Jen's mood more. He missed the wrestling contest between Aubryn, a woodsman, and Jeff, the huntsman. He only heard about the foot race won by his friend Gant and was upset. Jen's height and quickness had earned him the foot race crown of Tell for 4 years running. He missed the apple bobbing, pole climbing, chicken chasing, and the rousing games of white sticks. Worst of all, he missed the food. The magistrate rarely gave him a few moments between songs before he planted his feet on his front porch, put his hands on his hips, and screamed for them to keep at it. Even the good-natured Raphael showed signs of an eroding patience near mid-afternoon. Madlena eventually took pity on them, emerging from her inn with a basket of hot rolls and 2 mugs of cider. They had to take turns playing to let the other eat, and while Jen was grateful that the plump innkeeper had the kindness to bring them a little bread, his stomach pined at the smell of roasting meats, cow, pheasant, and pig, wafting through the square. He thought of asking Gant to get him a slice of pheasant, but his friend spent his time in the company of Yurl, Master Owen's bossy daughter. Yurl and Gant had been very close of late. Since Owen liked Gant almost as much as Raphael liked Jen, Jen had no doubt that Yurl and Gant would be betrothed come spring, and married the next fall.
"Jen," Raphael whispered after a song, "there's Regina. Go to her. Now's your chance. I'll hold up for a song or two without you."